You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of The Light Course, a cycle of lectures given by Rudolf Steiner to the new Waldorf School teachers. This is Lecture 2, given in Stuttgart on December 24th, 1919. Yesterday I spoke to you about how one side of natural science is the merely kinematic, which we achieve through the life of the imagination, simply by forming concepts about all physical processes in terms of number, space, and movement. We are able to fabricate the kinematic, so to speak, whole cloth, out of the life of the imagination. It is quite significant that the mathematical formulas we obtain concerning number, space, and movement do actually fit the natural processes themselves. On the other hand, it is equally significant that the moment we advance past number, space, and movement only as far as mass, we have to refer to outer experience. Yesterday we explained this for ourselves and also gained from this the insight that modern physics has to make this leap from the inner reconstruction of natural events by kinematics into external sense experience without actually being able to understand the leap. You see, without taking steps to understand this leap, it will be impossible ever to gain a conception of what should be called the ether in physics. For example, as I pointed out to you yesterday, according to present-day physics, although it has started to become uncertain about these notions, light and color effects act upon us as sentient beings, as beings with nerves or even with souls, but these effects are subjective. What happens out there in space and time is objective movement in the ether. However, if you look into the literature of contemporary physics or elsewhere in the world of physics for the ideas that have developed about this ether, which supposedly creates the phenomena of light, you will find that these ideas are contradictory and confused, and that you cannot get a proper idea about the ether, in quotes again, with the tools modern physics has at its disposal. We want to try to take the path that will bridge the chasm between kinematics and mechanics. For it is the latter, of course, that deals with forces and masses. I want to present a formula to you today just as a theorem. What it expresses will not occupy us until later, so those of you who may not recall it from your school years will be able to review what is necessary to understand it. I will put the elements together so that you can see this formula for a moment in your mind's eye. Let's assume now, in accordance with the principles of kinematics, that a point, parenthesis, we always have to speak of a point, close parenthesis, moves in this direction. We are looking now only at the movement, not at its cause. Such a point will move either faster or slower, so we can say that it moves with greater or lesser velocity. Let's call the velocity V. Thus, this is a greater or a lesser velocity. As long as we do not pay attention to anything but the fact that such a point moves with a certain velocity, we remain within the bounds of kinematics. However, with such a notion, we would not arrive at nature, not even purely mechanical nature. If we want to get to nature, we have to consider both what causes the point to move and the fact that a purely imaginary point cannot move. That is, if it is to move, the point must be something in external space. In short, we have to assume that a force acts on this point. I will call the velocity V, and the force that acts on this point F. Let's assume that this force does not push, so to speak, just once on this point in order to move it, causing it to fly off at a given velocity, as long as it meets no obstacles. Instead, let's begin with the assumption that this force acts continuously. In other words, the force acts on the point along its entire path. And let's call the distance along which this force acts on the point D. We also have to take into account the fact that the point must be something in space, and this something can be larger or smaller. Depending on whether this something is larger or smaller, we can say that the point has a greater or smaller mass. For the moment, we will express the mass in terms of weight. We can weigh what the force moves and express it in terms of weight. Let's then call the mass M. Of course, if force F acts on mass M, a certain effect must take place. This does not manifest itself in the masses having a constant velocity, but rather in its moving faster and faster. The velocity becomes greater and greater. In other words, we have to take into account that we are dealing with an increasing velocity. A smaller force acting on the same mass will be able to effect a smaller increase in velocity, while a larger force acting on the same mass will be able to effect a larger increase in velocity. Let's call this measure of the increase in velocity the acceleration, and indicated by the symbol A. And here I want to remind you of a formula that you probably already know, but should recall, for what interests us above all is the following. If you multiply the force that acts on the mass by the distance, you get a product equal to, that is, it can be expressed by, the mass multiplied by the square of the velocity, all divided by 2. That is, Fd equals mv squared over 2. Looking at the equation, you see that the mass is on the right side. You can gather from the equation that the bigger the mass is, the more force is required. However, what interests us now is that we have mass on the right side of the equation, the thing we can never arrive at through kinematics. Should we simply admit that everything lying beyond the bounds of kinematics has to remain forever inaccessible, so that we can only get to know it from staring at it, so to speak, from observation? Or is there a bridge between kinematics and mechanics that modern physics cannot find? Modern physics is unable to find the transition point, and the consequences are appalling, because it has no real science of the human being, no real science of physiology. For in actuality, we do not know the human being. If I write v squared, I have something that has to do purely with number and movement. To that extent, it is a kinematic formula. If I write m, I have to wonder if there is something in me that corresponds to m in a way similar to the way my conception of number and space correspond. For example, to what I designate with v. What corresponds to M? What am I doing here, actually? Physicists are normally not aware of what they are doing by writing M. This leads us back to the question, is there any way I can comprehend what is contained in M that is similar to the way I use kinematics to comprehend V? We can do this if we realize the following. If you press on something with your finger, you become familiar to an extent with the simplest form of pressure. Indeed, mass reveals itself initially in no other way than in its being able to exert pressure. Parenthesis, as I have already told you, you can visualize mass by weighing it. Close parenthesis. You can get to know such pressure by pressing on something with your finger. However, now we must wonder if something happens in us when we press on something. In other words, when we experience pressure. That is similar to comprehending a moving body. Yes, something of this kind does occur. You can understand what happens by making the pressure stronger and stronger. Just try. Rather, it is better not to try, exerting pressure on a spot on your body and increasing the pressure, making it stronger and stronger. What will happen? If you make it strong enough, you will faint. In other words, you will lose your consciousness. You can infer from this that this phenomenon of loss of consciousness also takes place on a small scale so to speak, if you only exert tolerable pressure. You just lose so little of the force of consciousness that you are still able to stand it. However, what I have characterized as a loss of consciousness under pressure so great that you cannot tolerate it is partially present on a small scale whenever we come, somehow, into contact with the effect of pressure, with the effect that emanates from a mass. Now you only have to pursue this thought further, and you will not be far from understanding what we designate with M. While everything that is kinematic is unified with our consciousness in a neutral way, so to speak, we are not in this situation with that which is designated with M. Rather, with M, our consciousness is instantly deadened. We can tolerate small doses of this deadening. Large ones are beyond us. Fundamentally, however, in both instances, it is the same thing. When we write M, we write something in nature that cancels our consciousness out when united with it. That is, it puts us partially to sleep. Thus we enter into a relationship with nature, but one that partially puts our consciousness to sleep. You see why that cannot be pursued kinematically. The kinematic is completely neutral to our consciousness. If we go beyond it, we enter areas that are opposed to our consciousness and cancel it out. Therefore, when we write the formula FD equals MV squared over 2, we have to say that human experience includes M as well as V, but that our ordinary consciousness does not suffice to comprehend M. This M immediately drains away the power of our consciousness. Here you have a real relationship to the human being, a completely real relationship to the human being. You see that states of consciousness have to be used in order to understand what is in nature. Without their help, we will not even succeed in making just the step from kinematics to mechanics. Nevertheless, even if we cannot live with our consciousness in anything that can be designated by M, for example, we do live in it with our whole selves as human beings. In particular, we live in it with our will, and we live very strongly in it with our will. Let me give you an example to illustrate how we live in M, in nature, with our will. Once again, I have to start out from something you will remember from your school years. I'm going to recall something for you that you were well acquainted with during your school years. You know that if we have a scale here, and there's a picture, and put a weight on it here, and then take an equally heavy object, which I am just going to hang here, in order to balance the scale, then we determine the object's weight. The moment we place a vessel of water here, filled to here, there's an illustration, and immerse the weight in water, the scale beam immediately rises. By being immersed in water, the object becomes lighter, loses some of its weight. And if we check to see how much lighter it has become, if we note how much we have to subtract to bring the scale into equilibrium once again, then we find that the object has lost a weight equal to the weight of the water it displaced. Thus weighing this volume of water gives us the loss of weight. You know that this is called the law of buoyancy, which states that a body in a liquid becomes lighter by a weight equal to the weight of the liquid it displaces. Therefore, as you can see, when a body is in a liquid, it strives upward, thus escaping to a certain extent from the downward pressure, the weight. In this way, we are able to observe by objective physical means something that has great significance in the constitution of the human being. On the average, the human brain weighs 1,250 grams. If the brain were actually to weigh 1,250 grams when we carry it in ourselves, then it would press down so strongly on the blood vessels under it that it could no longer be properly supplied with blood. A heavy pressure would be exerted, which would instantly cloud our consciousness. In reality, the brain doesn't press down on the base of the skull cavity with its full 1,250 grams at all, but only with 20 grams. That is because the brain floats in the cerebrospinal fluid. Just as this body here floats in the water, the brain floats in the cerebrospinal fluid. And the weight of the cerebrospinal fluid that is displaced by the brain is equal to approximately 1,230 grams. The brain becomes that much lighter and then weighs only 20 grams. That means that if we regard the brain as the tool of our intelligence and of our soul life, at least of a part of our soul life, as we indeed do with a certain amount of justification, then we should not be thinking only in terms of the weighable brain, for that is not the only thing there. Rather, by means of this buoyancy, the brain actually strives upward against its own weight. That means that with our intelligence, we do not live in forces that pull us downward, but rather in forces that pull us upward. With our intelligence, we live in a state of buoyancy. What I have explained to you applies only to the brain. The other parts of our organism, from the base of the skull down, are in this situation only to the smallest extent, with the exception of the spinal cord. But on the whole, the other parts of the organism push downward. In the brain, we live in buoyancy, striving upward. Otherwise, we live in the downward pull. Our will definitely lives in the downward pull. It has to unite with the downward pressure, but its consciousness is thereby taken away. Because of this, it sleeps continually. That is precisely the essence of the phenomenon of will, that it is extinguished as a conscious phenomenon because it unites with the force of gravity, which is directed downward. And our intelligence becomes luminous because we are able to unite with buoyancy, because our brain works against the force of gravity. You see, because of the different ways human life is united with the material basis, the submerging of the will in matter is effected on the one hand, and the enlightening of the will into intelligence on the other. Intelligence could never arise if our souls were bound solely to downward-pulling matter. If we do not look at human beings in the abstract way of today, but look at them as they really are, we will actually experience that the spiritual comes together with the physical. But the spiritual must be conceived so strongly that it can also embrace physical knowledge. On the one hand, through a special union with material life, specifically with the buoyancy in material life, the enlightening into intelligence, and on the other hand, through being put to sleep, when we have to let the will be drained away, so to speak, by downward pressure, making the will act in accordance with this downward pressure. This is the way that the will acts. Only a small part of it filters through to the area of 20 gram pressure and enters into intelligence. Thus, intelligence is imbued with will to an extent, but in essence, with intelligence, we are dealing with something that is opposed to ponderable matter. By thinking, we always strive beyond our heads. Here you can see how physical knowledge must be merged with that which lives in the human being. If we remain within the bounds of kinematics, we are dealing with the abstractions that are so popular today, and we cannot build a bridge between them and the external reality of nature. We need knowledge with a spiritual content strong enough to really immerse itself in the natural phenomena, so that it can grasp, for example, how physical weight and buoyancy work within the human being. Now, I have shown you how human beings come to terms internally with the downward pressure and buoyancy. In other words, how they live into the interrelation between the kinematic and the material. But you see, for this we need a new scientific deepening. We cannot do it with the old scientific way of thinking, which invents wave movements or emissions that are nothing but pure abstractions. It seeks the path across to matter by means of virtual speculation, but naturally cannot find it in this way. A truly spiritual science seeks the path across into matter by trying to really immerse itself in matter, by pursuing will and intelligence in the soul life, right down into the phenomena of pressure and buoyancy. Then you have real monism, which can arise only out of spiritual science, not the lip service monism that is driven so strongly by ignorance these days. But it is especially necessary for physics, if you will excuse the expression, to get some smarts in its head by making the connection between the phenomena out there and the physiological phenomenon of the floating brain. Once we have that connection, we know that is the way it must be, for Archimedes' principle cannot be invalid for the brain floating in cerebrospinal fluid. Now, what happens, though, as a consequence of the fact that with the exception of the 20 grams where the unconscious will comes into play, we actually live by means of our brains in the sphere of intelligence? To the extent that we use our brains as a tool, our intelligence is relieved of the burden of downward pulling matter. This is eliminated to such a high degree that a weight of 1,230 grams is lost. Matter is cancelled out to a very high degree. Through its being cancelled out to such a high degree, we are in the position to make our etheric body work for our brain to a particular extent. The etheric body can do what it wants because it is not diverted by the heaviness of matter. In the rest of our organism, the etheric is overwhelmed by the heaviness of matter. Thus the human being is organized in such a way that the etheric is free for everything that serves our intelligence. For everything else, the etheric is bound to physical matter. Thus, for our brain, the etheric organism drowns out the physical organism, and for the rest of the body, the arrangement and forces of our physical organism drown out those of the etheric organism. I have already drawn your attention to the relationship you enter into with the outer world when you subject yourself to pressure. There is a narcotic effect. But there is also other relationships, one of which I would like to anticipate today. The relationship to the outer world that sets in when we open our eyes in a brightly lit room. Obviously, in this situation, an entirely different relationship to the outer world takes place than when we collide with matter and are introduced to pressure. Indeed, when we expose ourselves to light, not only do we lose nothing of our consciousness, but to the extent that light acts solely as light, any of us who so desire can feel how our consciousness takes an interest in the outer world when we expose ourselves to light, so that it virtually becomes more awake. The forces of consciousness unite in a certain way with what we encounter in the form of light. We will discuss that more precisely later. However, in light and under light, we also encounter color. Light is actually something we cannot say we see at all. With the aid of light, we can see color, but we cannot actually say we see light. Why we see so-called white light, we will discuss later. Everything that we encounter as color appears to us as a polar phenomenon, just as, say, magnetism appears to us as a polar phenomenon, positive magnetism, negative magnetism. In the same way, we also encounter color as a polar phenomenon. One pole is everything that we designate as yellow, for instance, and related to yellow, orange, and reds. The other pole is blue, and everything that we designate as related to blue, indigo, violet, and even lesser shades of green. Why do I say that color appears to us as a polar phenomenon? If I may say so, the polarity of color must be thoroughly studied as one of the most significant phenomena in all of nature. If you want to get right down to what Goethe called the archetypal phenomenon, in the sense that I explained to you yesterday, you can arrive at the archetypal phenomenon of color first by searching for color in and under light. Today, as a first experiment, we want to try as well as we can to seek out color in and under light. First, I will explain the experiment to you. We can do it as follows. We will let light pass through a small opening, which we will assume to be circular, cut into an otherwise opaque wall, and there's a figure. We let the light flood in through this opening. If we set up a screen opposite this wall, the light pouring in causes a lighted circular area to appear. The best way to conduct the experiment is to cut a hole in the window shutter to let the light flood through, and then set up a screen to capture the resulting image. We cannot do that here, but we can do it with the help of this projector by removing the cap. Then, as you can see, we get a shining circular area, which is initially nothing but the image that results because a beam of light produced here is captured on the opposite wall. Now we push a so-called prism into the path of this beam of light, preventing the light from simply reaching the facing wall and creating a circle there. Instead, it is forced to deviate from its path. We cause that to happen by using a hollow prism, which is put together such that we have glass panes arranged in a wedge. Again, there's a picture. This hollow prism is filled with water. We let the light beam created here pass through this water prism. Now, if you look at the wall, you see that the disk of light is not at the same place down here where it was before. Instead, you see that it is raised. It appears at a different place. Besides that, you notice something else remarkable. Above, you see the edge is a bluish-green light with a bluish-green edge, a bluish edge. Below, you see a reddish-yellow edge. There we have what we call a phenomenon. Let's hold on to this phenomenon for a moment. If we note down the facts, we have to note them thus. Somehow, the light deviates from its path by going through the prism. It forms a circle up there. If we measured it, we would find that it isn't an exact circle. Rather, it is lengthened at the top and bottom, and at the top it has a bluish edge, and at the bottom a yellowish edge. Thus, you see, if we allow such a beam of light to pass through prismatically shaped water, we can ignore the changes caused by the glass plates, then color phenomena appears on the edges. Now I am going to do the experiment once more with a much narrower beam of light. You now see a much smaller disk down here. If we divert this little disk by means of the prism, you see the spot of light up here, in other words, once again displaced upward. However, now you see that the circle of light is almost completely taken up by colors. If we want to draw what you have here now, you see that what is displaced up here appears violet, blue, green, yellow, and red. Indeed, if we could investigate it completely, it would be arranged in perfect rainbow colors. Please, we are considering the facts, and I ask all of you who in school studied all the beautiful drawings of rays of light, of angles of incidence, and so forth, to please forget them, and to stick with the pure phenomenon, the pure fact. We see colors arise in and under light, and we can wonder why it is that such colors arise. If I put in the big circle, once again, we have the light beam passing through space and falling there on the screen where it forms an image. If we once again place the prism in the path of this light beam, then we get the deviation of the image, and in addition, the color phenomena on the edges. Now, however, I would like to ask you to observe the following. We will stay purely within the facts. I am asking you to observe that if you just look around a bit, you see the shining water cylinder right there as the light travels through the glass prism. The light beam passes, this is purely factual, through the water prism. And the light and the water fit into each other. Please, pay close attention to this now. When the light beam passes through the water prism, the light and the water fit into each other. The light and water do not fit into each other without having an effect on the environment. Instead, we have to say, the light beam passes and, staying within the facts, as I said, somehow has the force to penetrate the prism and reach the other side. However, the prism diverts the light beam. It would go straight, but it is raised and diverted, so that we have to realize that something is present that diverts our light beam. If I want to indicate with an arrow what diverts our light beam, I would have to do it with this arrow. Now we can say, staying purely with the facts and not speculating, that the light is diverted upward by such a prism, and we can indicate the direction of the diversion. Now, I ask you to think along the following lines, which once again just correspond to the facts. If you allow light to pass through a semi-opaque milk glass, or through any semi-opaque liquid, in other words, through semi-opaque matter, the light will naturally be weakened. If you look at light through clear water, you see its brightness. In semi-opaque water, it appears weakened. You can observe in countless cases how light is weakened by a semi-opaque medium. We have to declare this as a fact. In any case, however, every material medium, even this one here, figure 2c, that is acting as a prism, is semi-opaque. It darkens the light. In other words, with the light within the prism, we are dealing with a darkened light. On the left here, we are dealing with shining light. On the right here, we are dealing with light that has made its way through the medium. However, here, inside the prism, we are dealing with a combination of light and matter, with the origin of this darkening. You can gather that a darkening is taking effect simply by the fact that when you look at light through a semi-opaque material, you also see something else. Thus a darkening takes place. This is perceptible. What arises because of this darkening? We are not dealing simply with a light cone that turns aside and continues, but also with what comes into play as a darkening of the light caused by matter. We can conceive of this as follows. It is not only the light that is radiating into this space beyond the prism, but it is also the turbidity within the prism that is radiating into there. How? It spreads out naturally after the light has passed through the prism. The turbidity radiates into the brightness. And you only need to think about the matter in the right way to say to yourself that the turbidity shines upward, that when the brightness is diverted, the turbidity is also diverted upward. That is to say, the turbidity is diverted upward in the same direction in which the brightness is diverted. Turbidity is relayed, so to speak, into the brightness that has been diverted upward. The brightness cannot just spread itself out up there. Turbidity is relayed into it. We are dealing with two collaborators, with the diverted brightness and with the relaying of turbidity into this brightness. But the diversion of turbidity happens in the same direction as that of the brightness. You can see the result. Because turbidity shines upward into the brightness, the dark and bluish colors arise. Down below, what is it like there? Naturally, turbidity is also shining downward. However, as you see, while one part of the radiating light is up here, with the turbidity going in the same direction as the surging light, we have here a spreading out of what arises as turbidity, so that it shines in, and there is a space in which the light, for the most part, is diverted. But turbidity radiates into this body of light that has been diverted upward. Here we have an idea where turbidity, passing through the upper areas of the prism, goes downward. Because of this, we have down here an area where turbidity is diverted in a way that is opposed to the brightness. We can say that here we have turbidity that wants to go into the brightness, but in the lower part, the brightness is such that in its diversion, it works counter to the diversion of the turbidity. The result is that on the one hand, up here, the diversion of turbidity takes place in the same way as that of the brightness. They both collaborate to an extent, and turbidity intervenes like a parasite, so to speak. On the other hand, down here, turbidity radiates back into the brightness, but is overwhelmed by it and suppressed to a certain degree. Thus the brightness dominates here, and also dominates in the battle between brightness and turbidity. The results of this confrontation, and of the brightness shining through the turbidity, are the red or yellow colors down below. Thus we can say that up here, turbidity courses into brightness, and blue tones arise. Down below, brightness drowns out the turbidity, or darkness, that is radiating in, and yellow tones arise. You see that here, simply because the prism diverts the complete cone of light on the one side and the turbidity on the other side, in the two directions we are dealing with different ways in which darkness plays into brightness. Let me read that sentence again. You see that here, simply because the prism diverts the complete cone of light on the one side and the turbidity on the other side, in the two directions we are dealing with different ways in which darkness plays into brightness. We have an interplay of darkness and lightness, which do not mix to become gray, but instead remain independently effective. But toward the one pole, they remain effective in such a manner that the darkness works toward the brightness to a degree, thus working to carry weight into the brightness, but as darkness. On the other side, the turbidity resists the brightness, remaining an independent presence, but is drowned out by the brightness. There, the bright yellowish colors arise. By staying purely with the facts and taking what is there purely from observation, you have the possibility of understanding why the yellows appear on the one side and the blues on the other. And at the same time, you can conclude that the material prism plays an important role in the emergence of the colors. Indeed, it is because of the prism that on one side the turbidity is diverted in the same way as the cone of light, while on the other side what is radiating forth and what is diverted cross, because the prism also lets its darkness radiate out to the other side. Where a diversion has already taken place. Because of this, the diversion downward takes place, and darkness and brightness collaborate differently, downward then upward. Thus colors emerge wherever darkness and brightness work together. That is what I wanted to make especially clear to you today. If you want to consider now the best tack to take in order to understand this, then you have only to consider that your etheric body is engaged differently in the muscle than in the eye, i.e. In the muscle, it connects itself with the functions of the muscle. But, because the eye is very isolated, the etheric body is not engaged there in the physical apparatus. Rather, it is relatively independent. Because of this, the astral body is able to achieve an intimate connection with a part of the etheric body in the eye. Within the eye, our astral body is independent in quite a different way than in the rest of our physical organization. Assume that this, and there's a drawing, is a part of the physical organization in a muscle, and that this is the physical organization of the eye. If we describe it, we have to say that our astral body is engaged here as well as there, but there is a considerable difference. There it is engaged in such a way that it passes through the same space as the physical body, but not independently. Here in the eye it is also engaged, but it acts independently. Both fill out space in the same way, but in one instance the ingredients act independently, while in the other they do not act independently. Therefore, if we say that our astral body is in the physical body, it is only half of the story. We have to ask how it exists there, for it exists differently in the eye than in a muscle. Despite being in the eye just as it is in the muscle, the astral body is relatively independent in the eye. Thereby you can conclude that ingredients can penetrate each other and yet remain independent. Thus you can unite brightness and darkness to form gray. Then they interpenetrate like astral body and muscle. Alternatively, they can penetrate each other such that they remain independent. Then they interpenetrate like our astral body and the physical organization of the eye. In the first instance, gray emerges. In the second instance, color. If they penetrate each other like the astral body and muscle, gray emerges, and if they penetrate each other like the astral body and the eye, UIE again, then color emerges, because they remain relatively independent, despite being in the same space. The end of Lecture 2.